It's been said that we imagine our past and remember our future. And in no other aspect of human experience is that more true than in discussing family living. Our popular collective memory, our own memory, of the past of American families includes pictures of whole families gathered at the fireside. The cat is on the hearth, the children are industriously doing their schoolwork, mother and grandmother are crocheting and mending, father reads from the Bible in preparation for evening prayer. Each is virtuously tired from accomplishing designated tasks. Everyone believed in God, was chaste before marriage and faithful after marriage. Men were sober and industrious, few of words. Women were softly yielding and nurturant, yet firm in principle and high-mindedness. The sociologist William Goode has pointed out the fantasy qualities of this classical family of Western nostalgia. We imagine a past in which there is no evidence that the large household bursting with kin ever was the prevailing form. Most houses were very small compared to houses today. Most families were nuclear. And we remember our future in that hopes are expressed and predictions are made, not in terms of what might be in the future, but in terms of what we have valued and what we bring from our present and past. And the most potent being the dream of a stable family in a stable society. Professor Holt, in the very first session of this series, Metro 2000, gave us an example of the remembered future when he recreated what the future must have seemed at 25-year intervals, 1900, 1925, 1950. And we find that life in 1975 is very different from that which might have been predicted in 1950, and very same as that which might have been predicted in 1950. Statements about the future are usually predictions, and they show about some specifics of the family of the future. There will be more leisure with greater happiness. It's one prediction. It's based on past attitudes that work is drudgery imposed on man by an angry God. So if there's less work, there's greater happiness. Families will get smaller, based on a remembered depression when costs of supporting a family was accounted in terms of all too scarce money. Families will get larger, remembering the satisfaction we knew as members of large, kin, extended families. Children will have less moral guidance as a result of more women working outside the home. Some predict that the family will be stronger in the future because the pressure of societies are so great that people will be pushed deeper into the family bosom as protection against the stormy outside. Some predict the family will disappear because it has already lost many of its functions to other institutions, and so society will no longer need the family. Well, as is readily seen, such excursions into the future are by way of memory of days past. We will return somehow to that dream of happiness and comfort and innocence and a secure, stable, predictable society for our intimate relationships. But the model of the nuclear family that was considered the ordained natural universal model seems suddenly threatened, and its relevance to the present is questioned. Replacements have been suggested: swinging marriages, communes, polygamous arrangements, non-familial child rearing have all been well publicized in the mass media, which has decided that such ideas were news. At any rate, the media succeeded in helping to make such alternatives to the nuclear family a part of our consciousness. It's only natural, then, that thinking people should ask, what of the future of the family? I don't want to dodge the question of family structure in 2000, But I do want to avoid the certain folly of prediction based on present trends or on faulty memory. So I find myself somewhat in the position of the instructor at Yale who was reported for censure for having given the same examination for two consecutive terms. It's true, I did give the same examination twice, said the instructor to his chairperson, but I changed the answers. It seems to me that we ask the same questions, but we start shifting some answers around. My answers, or an effort to answer, is a very personal statement to you, based on my belief that I want the family to continue and that I feel the family, believe the family, should be planned toward, that the family of the future should develop from choices made. The 5 points I want to make, I'll spend just a half a second on each, and we'll still make it. Much sociological, anthropological, and psychological literature on the family promotes the nuclear family in a sort of utopian mold. That is, the ideal of mutual love and support, allegiance to the group, achievement to promote natural, to promote mutual pride. It's a static kind of setting in which everyone does his work. Well, you remember from our family of nostalgia. As a functional part of the social structure, the family serves the equilibrium of the system by carrying out its vital functions, replacing the population, training or socializing the young, and providing affectional affiliation for the adults. The family adapts to changes in other societal institutions and adapts to change which come from within, the coming of children, aging, illness, so forth. The goal is homeostasis, that is, to get back to equilibrium. By popular thought, marriage and children are thought of as settling. When we marry, we settle down. We have and do think of the family as a natural source of happiness and fulfillment and satisfaction. But reality demands, at the very least, that we also consider other models for the family if we are seriously concerned about the future. The sociologist Dahrendorf suggests that since change, the unusual, and conflict are the constants in society, that a homeostasis model is not relevant and proposes a conflict model of society. Now, considering the family as a subsystem within the larger societal system, it seems appropriate to consider the conflict model for a moment as a possible corrective to this utopian homeostasis model. If Dahrendorf's conflict model is too heady a concept, we might posit a problem-solving model. And instead of assuming that family life remains the same unless or until some event demands explanation and therefore change, we might assume that change and development are the norm and that these only stop when some event intervenes. We then find that we will be exploring what stopped the change rather than what caused the change. Hoping for a future projected family life based on equilibrium of interlocking roles is nostalgia multiplied by naught. Second, we need to clarify what and who a family is. Several structures are operating today: monogamy, polygamy, same-sex group, the nuclear family, tribal family, commune, the extended family. But it isn't the family form which is the cause or the solution to family problems. If structure were the cause or cure, one of these alternative structures would have provided a solution. But the problem lies within the social context, not in the form of the family. Some of these forms in which families are living are denied legal and social sanctions, which means that such experiments have to fail. Or, if they survive at all, it has to be against the community and outside the law. We define families in legal terms, social terms, residence terms, bloodlines, functional contexts, and these are by no means the same kind of definition. With my class in family relationships, we spend a session or two on trying to come to a commonly accepted definition of the family. The difficulties are complex. The third, we need to expend ourselves on experimental social innovations by creating new social subsystems as alternative solutions to intimate living. Different models can be established and evaluated, and then they can be implanted and nurtured in the community to determine if and how they meet human needs. Professor Hirschbell and Professor Henry have each shown how the family has changed through history, and some of these family changes are enormous. Let me refresh your memory just a moment. In terms of the pater familias, the family was defined in terms of household, and the household was the basis of the family, not the husband and wife marriage. That changed to husband and wife as the base of the family. The early Christian was reported an indifference to children, to having defined for us in the colonial family that the most important function of family is the upbringing of children. We changed from women as a vital part vital partners in contributing to the support of the family, where in which the husband and wife shared the provider role, to women being kept at home and not participating in the provider role, to women justifying sharing in the provider role, to one-third of the labor force being composed of women. The father was an important participant in the socialization of children in the colonial family, changed to the father as extraneous to his son learning work or a trade. The pater familias of Roman times had complete authority over his family, to a diminution of parental authority at the early age of 6 or 7. The father is an economic provider in which father was a part-time, fathering was a part-time occupation, to the trend of the time urging fathers to become more involved in children's socialization and shift in that basic role. That means to me that we are talking about an institution that through its history has changed and has changed quite radically. The fourth point I'd like to make is that education for intimate living needs to be instituted in all our schools and throughout our communities. By this I mean more than knowledge about families and sexuality. I mean cognitive and effective education for nurturance, for conflict management, for giving and receiving pleasure, for recreative activities, time and money management, aging, parenthood, developmental stages, family roles, creative expression, household management skills, decision making, and how to affect change in the social system. Accepting suicide, doing what comes naturally, is the least satisfactory of possible solutions to problems of intimate living. Finally, families will need to get organized, both for protection from social policy, which may be hurtful to the family and impede change, and for affirmative action for instituting adequate family support systems. In order to establish balance in governmental thinking, the needs of families and the effect of legislations on families need to be kept constantly in the attention of legislative bodies. Our state and federal governments give support directly and indirectly in terms of money, time, consultation to universities, to agriculture, to manufacturing firms, to airlines, to railroads, to small business. But lacking organization, who can speak for families? If we want to participate in the goods of this society, then the families have to be organized and form the kind of pressure group that gets action in terms of value of families. Well, I've tried to make the point, these points, that the family can realistically and profitably be considered as a change agent, a growth agent, a problem-solving group, a development motivator. I've said that we need to grant legal rights and privileges to various structures as families. We need to innovate models for intimate living, and we need to establish education for family living for all ages and stages of the life cycle. And I've said that families need to get organized. These five considerations comprise my thinking at the time about the family structures in the year 2000. But to the question, what will the family structure of the future be like? Another answer, which is satisfactory to me, would be, what kind of families do we want? It's 3:25. You have 5 minutes if you want to react. It takes more than 5 minutes. But, Thank you. That's very nice of you to say that. Yes?
I'm a little frustrated in thinking of family as a unit. And what about the importance? I really referred to the father as an institution. Is each, then there's, you know, there's mother, there's children. Comprising the family. Is each one an institution in itself? Is a family an institution combining all, when you're talking about organizing for deciding what we want, or maybe society reflecting the needs of this institution? Is it individual fathers, mothers, and children fighting against, you know what I
yeah.
mean?
I think I hear what you're saying. I must have said it wrong in my push. I do not see the father as an institution. I see the family as the institution. The father is a cluster of roles, which means that the father in this institution has a position. Does that help? Yeah. However, it does seem to me that this is one of the pressures of today, and that is that the pressure is between the family as an institution and the individualism. That what is going to destroy the family might be much more our interest in individualism than it is some external pressure on the family.
So that no individual in the family, the mother is also a cluster of roles?
Yes. I just don't believe it's realistic for us to talk about the mother role. The mother has many roles. Child rearer, child bearer, sex partner, cook, chauffeur. She has many, many roles in the family. Well, the mother isn't a sex partner. I hope that's the wife. Yes. Yes, that's what I'm saying. Labor unions have done it. American Association of Manufacturers have done it. Yeah, why not? We've never tried that in our country. Yes.
You mentioned the social substance as alternative for intimate living.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Can you elaborate a little on social
substance? Yes, it would be limited only by our imagination. The social subsystems, the models that I mentioned that we might dream up and establish on an experimental basis, see if they can work, then implant them in the society and see if they can work out in the society, and give them some nurture to help them along. I don't believe it's revolutionary or radical to say at this stage that the nuclear family is in difficulty in our society. It's a very fragile institution. And if we want seriously to seek to find other ways, we might be exploring these other ways. And Sheila Henry mentioned some possible experiments that would be experiments for us that some are institutionalized in some other countries. But we haven't tried them. I don't know what they would be. I'd like to try one, though, that I can tell you that grows out of some concern for youth, and that is that there be homes in communities for youth on the junior high and high school level to govern themselves and to get them away from mother and father and our daily expectations. Well, no. 16, 17 years old, they can cook, they can sew.
I've been thinking there's a differentiation between right and wrong, and to the extent that they might have to in those things.
I don't know. Well, my view of development, you see, doesn't depend on chronological age. I know a fair number of adolescent 40-year-olds. Yeah. So, you know, see, yeah. I know some 16-year-old adults and 14-year-old adults. And we don't know what the ingredient is. That's why I say an experiment. Well, yes.
Doesn't that suggestion, though, tend to break down the family faster than build it up?
Well, it depends on what you call the family. I'm talking about an experiment that forms a new family. That's not based, as families have not always been based, on blood lines and blood relationships. Yes.
Don't you think taking socialization of the child completely away from the family and giving it to the institutions of education in this country is really eliminating the parent from the whole responsibility of that child?
I don't know if it'd eliminate the whole responsibility of the parents, but yes, it would take socialization away from being a biological, parental responsibility. Yes?
Provide emotional support and economic support, not only biological support.
The biological parents?
Yes.
Well, my children get a lot of support from lots of other people emotionally than from me. All our children do. School teachers, their peer groups, neighbors. Well, I don't believe there's anything in our history that says that because you bear a child, you have responsibility for that child. That's a social invention. And we can socially invent somebody else to have the responsibility for our children. The kibbutzim in Israel indicate that parents don't have to devote all of their time to socialization of children, and children grow up with a sense of belonging, emotional support. There are other ways and have always been other ways of doing things. Let me give you one example in our society. A woman bears a child. For some reason or other, she cannot keep the child. She hands the child to another woman, and this other woman who didn't bear the child socializes the child with love and affection and lifelong support. Now, she fulfilled the function. She didn't go through the biological process of bearing that child. And we might experiment with training people to be good mothers and have good mothering come from men or women, boys or girls, someplace, and do a good job of developing the kind of adults we wish we were.
I just don't think you can give them like their own.
You what? Say it again.
I said the institutionalization of the socialization is what I was referring to. You're talking about individual persons.
Well, we've institutionalized socialization in the nuclear family now. We've made it a very intense interaction between one parent, one child, or two parents and one child. That's an institutionalization of socialization. I'm suggesting that we might, in our wisdom, think up other ways of doing it. This is one way of doing it. There are other ways. You wanted to say something. We'll never know, will we? Because we won't turn loose of the little deers. Yeah.
And I think that, you know, you're not suggesting that you turn the child out alone. You're suggesting a pretty strong peer group.
In Dickens' time in England, read some of Dickens' novels. Children were out and on their own. They were turned loose and on their own. It's a cruel time, but it doesn't mean that we have to kick them out in that way if we surround them with some support system. I don't know. There's evidence that people will grow and mature and come through. Yes?
There's also the evidence provided by the child's family support and so forth.
Yes?
There's an experiment that you could comment.
Yes? This is the Charles Manson family. This is the kind of experiment I was referring to earlier that has to exist outside the law and against society because there's no support for it. One statistic. What I'm trying to do is blow you loose from where you are. If we're going to think about the future, we can't think about it in terms of what we remember from the past. If we're going to think about the future. The rate of divorce for teenage marriages, where both partners are married below the age of 20, is more than double the divorce rate for persons who are married at a later age. And some persons read that statistic and they say, teenage marriage is bad. We do everything possible in our society to make sure those teenage marriages will not last. We tell them you're not old enough, or if you get married, get out on your own. We don't do anything in this world to support them. Cut out school. You cannot get an education. You can't go to school. We're doing better about this. We used to say to girls, if you're married in school, you cannot participate in the educational advantages here. Get out. We do everything in the world to make this a bad thing. And then we say, look, they failed. They didn't fail. They didn't fail. The social system, the social context, did nothing to support them and encourage them. Does that help at all? I'm not saying Charles Manson family is the ideal family, but we